I guess you all know why I'm here. I need deputies. I'll take all I can get.
You must be crazy coming in here to raise a posse. Frank's got friends in this room. You ought to know that.
Some of you were special deputies when we broke this bunch. I need you again. Now.
Things were different then, Kane. You had six steady deputies to start off with. Everyone a top gun. You ain't got but two now.
You ain't got two. Our pal here says he just quit. Why?
That's between the two of us.
You're asking an awful lot, Kane, considering the kind of man Frank Miller is.
All right. We all know what Miller's like. That's why I'm here. How about it?
A modern day remake of Matthew Vaughn's Leia kick. A Coen brothers end up with Timothy Chalamet.
A Citizen Kane prequel, a Midnight Cowboy sequel. Alvin and the Chipmunks deserve another squeak.
There's so many new ways to revisit sideways, but a graphic novel is how we choose to update.
But we still hold fast, you can't change the past on the Ruined Childhoods podcast.
Greetings, Starfighters, Cattle Ranchers, and Bad Breakers. This is Ruined Childhoods. And on this episode, we're in the Land of Enchantment. This state is known for its UFO sightings, the art of Georgia O'Keeffe, and the Manhattan Project. Fun fact, this state has more PhDs than any other state per capita. PhD, more like ABQ, representing this state's largest city, Albuquerque. That's right, we're in New Mexico, talking about the 1952 Western High Noon. Dan, are you now or have you ever been a host of the Ruined Childhoods podcast?
I cannot tell a lie under oath. I am currently a co-host of the Ruined Childhoods podcast.
And I am glad for that. Dan, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going great, John. Why do you ask? Were you afraid I was going to desert you as part of the theme of this episode?
No, I was just going with the other theme of this episode, which is the Red Scare, communism, blacklisting.
Oh, yes. Of course, yes. So anyway.
Did that playful motif not come across in the introduction?
You know what it is? Perhaps I should explain. So it didn't set me specific, and I'm aware of High Noon's being, you know, allegory and about that, but I've also been listening to the audiobook of In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and have been listening. The last section I listened to were interrogations, and it's very much that line of thinking. So I responded more. It's like that's kind of what it sparked in my brain, rather than sparking the more relevant topic of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yes. I just thought it'd be fun. And you know, that's something that we talked about a little bit.
I fucked it up. Do you want to start? We could start over.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was just while you were answering that, I was like, oh no, he didn't get the reason why I asked.
I'm going to get blacklisted now.
Not at all. Not on my behalf. I can tell you that much.
Verbally stumbling into it. Jeez, it's a good thing. Well, I was not ever called in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
That would have been that would have gone a little something like this. No, I'm just kidding. So Dan, New Mexico. We just were in our home state of New Jersey, at least in terms of talking about movies on this podcast. Yes. Is New Mexico a place that's ever been, you know, at least on your radar to go visit? I don't think I remember you ever going to visit there.
No, you are. You are correct. I have never visited New Mexico, and I would say definitely on the radar in terms of, first of all, a state that I haven't visited, but also a state that I feel is like there's a certain beauty to it. And of course, being someone who's interested in history, especially 20th century history, seeing a lot of the places where Los Alamos, I don't know exactly what you can like tour there, but New Mexico and Roswell, like that would be fun. Yeah. That would be so, like, yeah, it's like it's on my radar. It's not like a to reference back to another film we've covered. It's not a bucket list destination.
Yeah,
I mean, you.
You know, no, I haven't been. Certainly the appeal of visiting Roswell and, you know, experiencing kind of that part of American culture is fascinating to me. Yeah. You know, certainly the Los Alamos aspect of New Mexico is interesting and certainly is very zeitgeisty. It's in the conversation.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think that's been a particular draw for me. I think that, you know, Breaking Bad was maybe more of a reason to go see, you know,
I don't know. Breaking Bad was a brilliant show.
Better Call Saul. But, you know, just to be like, oh, that's the strip mall where, you know, Saul's office was and stuff like that. I think that'd be interesting.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But for me, that would be more of a, hey, while I'm here. But even, totally. I don't know. Yeah, I can't think of a particular, like, other than, like, oh, like, Walter's house.
Right, which they, the owners absolutely hate that people go there and, like, try to throw pizzas on the roof and stuff like that. they absolutely hate it. And, but I think that, you know, I mean, Santa Fe seems really lovely. I'd love to go there.
Oh,
I know
there's some great
museums in the area.
Santa Fe seems cool.
Stuff. Yeah, I think that just to go and explore places like Santa Fe and, you know, other cultural landmarks would be a lot of fun. Certainly the New Mexico or New Mexico territory that is shown in High Noon is something that doesn't really exist anymore.
I would imagine not. New Mexico is not even a state in High Noon. It's a territory, which
it's territory
plays into the plot.
Yeah.
You know, motivations of some of the characters as it comes up, but
do we want to like get into High Noon?
Let's get into High Noon. And so how about a synopsis, and then I can tell you about a personal anecdote, because John,
ooh,
I have been to Hadleyville, New Mexico. Even though I've never been to New Mexico.
Ooh, I am intrigued.
I've been to Hadleyville, New Mexico. So, but tell, please share.
Okay.
What is it? Tell us about what happens in Hadleyville, New Mexico.
Well, first of all, at 7 minutes, this may be the earliest that we've gotten into a synopsis. So that's very exciting.
This is a movie that it is appropriate. This is a movie that runs efficiently on a tight schedule.
Yeah.
And
yes,
I think it's
absolutely.
Absolutely. We don't have time to waste. Let's gather the deputies.
So this synopsis, because this movie it's a bit layered, there are a lot of characters and there's a lot that you have to keep track of in a tight 84 minutes or so, that you know, there's a lot to keep track of. And so to do a synopsis without, I didn't want to give away the ending. We will give a spoiler alert when we need to, but because I feel like well, we'll see.
I'm saying you don't need to give away in the synopsis.
Yeah.
The synopsis, yeah, no. I think, for this can be pretty brief.
Sure.
But you're the synopsis man.
All right, then here we go.
Senor Synopsis.
Ooh, that's my name. Minutes after Marshal Will Kane is married to his new wife, Amy, he turns in his badge and hangs up his gun in order to move out of town and open a store with Amy, a Quaker who admonishes guns and violence of any kind. Minutes after that, the townsfolk of Hadleyville, New Mexico, discover that ex-con Frank Miller's gang has arrived at the train station and are awaiting their boss, who is on a train that arrives at noon. This is concerning because Miller was put away by Kane years prior and sentenced to death. However, lawmen in the north gave Miller a pardon, and he is on his way back to New Mexico to seek vengeance. Kane, who is no longer Marshal Kane, but Citizen Kane, decides to go against the wishes. I knew you'd get a chuckle out of that. Yeah, okay. Decides to go against the wishes of his new wife and stay in Hadleyville for one more hour to gather a posse and discourage Miller from starting any trouble. However, Kane is unable to adequately find anyone to help him. Meanwhile, while Amy is waiting for the noon train to leave town with or without her new husband, she has an encounter with Helen Ramirez, the owner and proprietor of the town store. Helen had a prior relationship with Will Kane, and Amy suspects that she has something to do with Will's drive to further protect the town from Frank Miller, who also used to date Helen. What Amy doesn't know is that Helen is also looking to leave town, especially after she dumps her latest beau, Deputy Marshal Harvey Pell. Harvey is considered a bit of a weak doofus rather than a man and has beef with Kane for not promoting him to Marshal in light of Will's departure. As noon approaches, Will Kane is left alone to protect the town from Frank Miller or die trying. And you know what, Dan? I unintentionally referred to Deputy Marshal Harvey Pell as Helen's latest beau, not because his son is Beau Bridges. Just because that's the word that I chose.
That's the word, and it just it was a happy coincidence there.
A happy coincidence.
Beau Bridges, who as legend has, was on set.
Yeah.
During the filming of this.
That's true, yeah. So Gary Cooper plays Will Kane. Grace Kelly is Amy. Lloyd Bridges is Harvey Pell. Cotty Hirado is Helen Ramirez. Lon Chaney Jr. is Martin Howe, who is the former marshal. Otto Kruger is Judge Percy Metrick. And then in the gang, we have Sheb Woolley. Sheb, a.k.a. writer of Purple People Eater Woolley, playing Ben Miller. We have Robert Wilkie as Jim Pierce, Lee Van Cleef as Jack Colby. And playing Frank Miller, we have Ian McDonald. And there's a bunch of other characters in this. It is certainly a robust film crammed into a tight, real-time film.
Yeah, it really is. And it does play out almost in real time. Not I would say not 100% in real time, but close enough.
It gets pretty dang close.
Yeah. And right. Impressive cast. It's hard to keep it straight who's who, and there's some people
I watched it twice just because so here's what the first time I watched it, maybe I just stopped listening for 2 seconds or got distracted. And the whole thing about Frank Miller being on the train and the three guys being his gang, because one of them is Ben Miller, his brother, I think it's right. Ben.
Yeah.
And so when I heard that it was Miller, I was like, wait, but isn't Miller there? And it was like, it wasn't until he actually gets off the train that I was like, oh, okay. I must have just missed that whole thing.
Oh, so you went pretty much the whole movie.
Pretty much the whole movie. Oh, and then when I watched it again.
Because he gets off the train like towards the end.
Yeah, within the last 15 minutes. Yeah, so when I watched it a second time, I was like, right. Okay. I missed that moment right there where that's explained.
And I had a similar experience where I put it on again, just because there was a moment where I think I was like you were distracted by something. And there was something else that I felt like, okay, I feel like I missed something. And one of the things I missed is spoilering. It doesn't matter.
So, yeah, another thing that I wasn't quite clear on the first time that I was watching it that was more clear the second time, again, probably because there was a piece of lint flying around in the air or something, but the whole thing about Harvey Pell being the deputy marshal, and so there's this whole thing about how they're kind of going a day without a marshal because he hands in his badge and his gun. He's going to go off. He's gotten married, but the new marshal isn't arriving until the next day. And yeah. I saw Lloyd Bridges with the badge on and I was like, oh, that must be the new marshal. Oh, he's just killing time with this lady instead of, you know, showing up. So I was like, oh, no. Okay. He's the deputy. And it wasn't until like the two of them, I think, are in like the barn getting into a fight that I'm like,
they tussle.
Oh, I see. Yeah. He wants to be that, but
there's a lot about him not being a real man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of implication, like the fact that they would rather, or that like Kane would rather some, like an unknown entity becomes deputy becomes marshal rather than the deputy marshal who's already there. Like that's saying something when you're getting passed over and you're like right there. It's like, you can't fill these shoes, pal. Sorry, Harv.
Yeah.
But it's okay because he gets to go on and be an admiral in the Navy and then president in Hot Shots Part Deux.
He does pretty well for himself, I'd say.
if you just forget that Lloyd Bridges was an actor who played different characters and you just think he was a man who traveled between films.
Right. But this was, I mean, early in his career, I mean, one of his first movies.
Yeah.
I think that he was like 40 when this was made, like 39 38. Or something. 38. So like, that's pretty old still to be like just getting your real start. But right. I mean,
well, they aged up all. Yeah. So like this is so the screenplay is based on a story called The Tin Star, though. Reportedly, it's very loosely based. And the producers bought the rights for The Tin Star because they were like, it's similar enough where we would get sued and have to settle. So they just bought the rights because they were like, that's going to be cheaper. So the characters are, I guess some of the characters are older because Gary Cooper, Will Kane is like 50. Gary Cooper was like 50 when they made this, and Grace Kelly was 21.
I'm rolling my eyes for anybody who's not watching on YouTube.
Yeah. So, and yes, I know, not unusual for the time in which this is set, which is somewhere in the latter quarter of the 19th century. It's 1870s. Yeah. It's in that. Definitely in 1870s because they're like a territory. They're not a state yet. It's set around there. Regardless, it's a little cringe. Reportedly, Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly did have an affair.
I know, which is even more cringe to me. But
also in hindsight, when you think about like what would make a 21-year-old actress have an affair with a 50-year-old actor, and then you just start to wonder. And
so, aside from all of the obvious things to consider, there, the one thing that I will say is that for his entire life, Gary Cooper was a hot piece of Hollywood ass. And he certainly was highly sought after by women throughout his entire professional career, which is even how he got to be in movies because, he was
sexy.
Spotted. He was spotted.
Sexy
and he was a
boy.
Hot dude. He was in Wings and he, it's like
the movie, not the show.
The movie. No.
Yeah. That was
Thomas Hayden Church.
Yeah. Also sexy. Also dead sexy. So, but let's compare contrast here. We recently talked about Clark Gable.
Yeah.
Another similarly aged star. Though I would say Gary Cooper is, and I know like this is 1952. The Misfits was like 10 years later.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm less gross. I'm not like I was kind of grossed out by Clark Gable. And it also went back to, I was thinking about Clark Gable and just the other roles he's known for playing. And it's just roles for guys who like tell women to shut up and sleep with him.
Yeah. Right.
So, stop your crying and open your legs. Yeah. So Gary Cooper to me is like, and it's the character. It's not, I know nothing about the man, Gary Cooper, but I know he played heroes. He played war heroes.
Yeah.
And he plays, and I love him in this.
Well, what's a little less sketchy about, and just comparing this to The Misfits with Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe, is that in The Misfits, we see how the two of them are getting together. And we know more about her backstory and the difficulties she's had growing up. And in this one, we meet them as they are getting married. We never, right. aside from them smooching when they get married, we never see them, you know, getting cozy or anything. That's it. And, there's actually a lot of similarities, I feel, between High Noon and The Misfits to talk about, aside from, like, you know, the Western aspects of it all and the age difference topic of conversation, but also the fact that with The Misfits, like we were talking about on that episode a little while back, is that it's hard to separate the content from the context, and the movie doesn't work as well without the context of what was going on behind the scenes with Marilyn right. Monroe and Arthur Miller. And similarly, High Noon works. I mean, if you didn't know about all of the things about the, like, the blacklisting and yeah. McCarthyism, like all of that, you know, High Noon could still work on its own as a movie, but it is made a better movie when you do know the context behind it.
And the first time I saw it, which I don't remember when the first time I saw it was, but within the last 10 years, but I watched it without any awareness of it other than knowing, okay, this is one of the all-time classics. Yeah. And Western is not often my go-to genre, but I'm trying to look at Westerns and find the value in them. And we've talked about a few of them on here, which have turned me around and made me want to look at Westerns, especially all the classics like the John Fords, which I've kind of written off. But High Noon was one yeah. of those that, and also it's short. So whenever I decided yeah. to watch it, I was probably like, oh, nice, under an hour and a half. I'm not going to fall asleep.
Something that I like about the Westerns that we've covered on this podcast is that they are very atypical Westerns. You know, you have yeah. the good, the bad, and the ugly, a spaghetti Western, iconic spaghetti Western. If you're going to do one, you do that one. Yeah. And then, you know, The Misfits, which is an outlier because it is about how cowboys are getting phased out. And it's like this era where people are like, you know, the older people are like grasping onto this life that they thought that they could have had. Like, it's a more nuanced movie. And then
it's like an anti-Western, but also a neo-Western. It's
true.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we have High Noon. And,
well, we did Tombstone. Tombstone's probably also the most traditional.
Tombstone's most traditional, but also, you know, it's 90s. It's got the hot stars of the time, iconic Val Kilmer role. There's yeah. the drama between that and the production of Wyatt Earp with Kevin Costner. Like, there's a lot more to it than, let's say, a John Wayne Western.
Right.
Which I feel like if we're going to take a John Wayne Western and something like High Noon, politically speaking, our leanings would bring us to High Noon.
Yes.
As opposed to pretty much any John Wayne movie, including, and he did one that was even like a response to High Noon that was like their own version of it with all of the kind of undertones of, you know, the Communist Party, like that whole thing, like, you know, trimmed out. And it's more of like a man's man Western kind of a movie.
Less of a conflicted, like, because Gary Cooper definitely plays like this. He plays this guy who's like, man, 10 years ago, I would have been like, whatever, deputies, who needs them?
Rio Bravo is the John Wayne movie that was a response to
Rio Bravo
one.
Was a response. Okay, I've never seen Rio yeah. Bravo, but now I have a reason.
I checked to see if it's not streaming anywhere, so I was like, I won't watch that one.
I don't have a reason to like turn it on as soon as we're done recording, but at some point, if I notice it's streaming, I might give it some attention. But
yeah, it's like a diss track.
But High Noon, man, like Gary Cooper, the acting and like in his eyes, and when you see the worry in his eyes, especially when he realizes that no one, spoiler alert,
yeah, well,
is going to help him.
When there's not a lot, scenes where there's not a lot or any dialogue, the eyes do, they do all the talking and the guns.
Yeah. But he's just, his, the look and his concern, like he's this guy who's got this, he's this image, and he's, it's also like kind of a play, I think, on the Gary Cooper persona. And yeah, like he's, Gary Cooper doesn't sweat the, like Frank Miller and his, like, his little three friends.
Yeah.
But Will Kane, now married.
Yeah.
Does.
Right. So I made one of my little what I like, what I didn't like lists.
Oh.
Because I there was a lot that I did like about it, but there were just a few things that I had some nitpicks with, some of which we've already mentioned, but I'll just kind of go through my list a little bit, if you don't mind. I mean, we talked about kind of the real time aspect of it. I love that it plays in almost real time. Yeah. This is, you know, an early movie to do something like that. And, you know, clearly the use of the showing, you know, showing all the clocks and the way that they, you know, score the music to kind of go along with like the pendulum swings and stuff like that is very effective. I mean, I believe it won the Academy Award for music. It definitely did for song, but I think it did for music as well. I thought that Grace Kelly was fantastic. Her whole backstory about why she became a Quaker is a really incredible scene. You know, she's kind of divulging that information to Helen, and and it gives you a lot more information that you like didn't know before. And it's like, does her husband know all of this? Like, I almost feel like I wish that there was some sort of indication of just like, and he knows all of this stuff. I don't know why he's continuing to be a marshal after we're married, knowing what he knows about me and everything. So it really puts you on her side. And I, that whole interaction between, Grace Kelly's got Amy and Helen Ramirez, like, I thought that that was really strong, and, the two have some great moments together.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I love that scene. I also love that scene because the movie kind of builds to it.
Yeah.
You're like, at some point, these two are going to get in the same room and it's going to be
showdown,
awkward. Yeah. But the part when they are heading to the train station on the carriage together and they pass Will, and I'm like, man, that's the iciest day in New Mexico ever.
Amy, all in white, fresh from her wedding. Yep. Helen Ramirez, all in black. It is intense. It's really incredible. I loved that. I thought that was the best part of the movie. It really made it for me. I really love that the audience is kind of with the townspeople, constantly trying to decide what they think Kane should do. Also,
what they think
like,
they should do,
what they think they should do, and what they think he should do. Yeah. It's really cool, especially like, you know, you see them, a lot of them at like the wedding scene, and they're just like, oh, you've been such a great marshal and we'd do anything for you and we're such good buddies. But then like when he asks them to do this, they're just like, I don't know, man. You might just want to like give it a rest and just like get out of here. And it's like not your problem anymore. And well,
and I want, fine. I want to, there's a scene I want to come back to and talk about with that. But also to connect to that, there's the guy who like, who comes right away and is like, Will, I'm with you. Like, I just want you to know when the time comes, I'm there. And then when it's like almost time, and he's like, all right, where's everyone else? And Will's like, no, it's just us. And he's like,
I've got like kids.
I figured there would be like maybe 50 of us against the four of them, and that I would just kind of like be in the back.
Yeah.
but like cheering there everybody still on. Like
yeah,
that, no, yeah, there's that guy, yeah.
Yeah, there's that guy. There's the guy with the eye patch who is in support, but it's like, I don't know about this guy. There's the 14-year-old kid who's going to support him, but he's like, no, don't do it, dude. You're a child.
Yes.
Yeah. You're 14. So the people who are willing to side with him and help him out, you know, there's a lot of question about should they? And it's not like an easy pick. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
And the scene, you're still in your list, so I don't want to break away.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna go back to Helen Ramirez for a second. She just rules. Yes. You know, she owns her own business, and which she sells, and she does it all on her own. She's sexually liberated. You know, she certainly knows how to pick them. I'll tell you that much.
And she calls the shots.
And she does call the shots, and she tosses out Harvey like a sack of potatoes. She's just like, I'm done with you. You're puny and like a little baby, and I don't have time for this.
She's like, you're cute. It was fun, and now it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, good for her. Also, it's like...
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm just like, she has that great line, like, I don't let a man touch me who I don't want to touch me, and I don't want you touching me. I'm paraphrasing. She says it much better, which is why this movie won Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah, and did she win a gold? I think she won the Golden Globe for this.
Well, she's supporting actress.
Supporting actress.
Let me see if that's actually
Golden Globe for supporting actress. Yeah,
nice.
I think so. Good job. she's great and deserves it. Just the filmmaking alone, there's a lot of intensity that comes with it that, you know, anytime you have like a literal ticking clock, you're going to get some intensity. And
the editing is fantastic.
The editing. Well, didn't the editing also win?
Also.
Yeah, Best Academy Award. Yeah. Academy Award for Best Editing. So the editing's incredible. And clearly the famous crane shot right before the thugs get to town, that's just like him being completely alone. There's not even a fly buzzing by. It's just like him and that's it.
The Hollywood Hills behind him.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much it for my what I like list. I mean, but the things that I liked a lot. And, certainly the backstory for like how this movie came together and those who were like gray listed who were involved and those who they think soon became blacklisted or you know or were blacklisted, it's you know what you certainly have to consider those moments I started to talk about this before. But when we were doing, what was our Michigan episode? Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, yeah. Anatomy of a Murder.
Anatomy of a Murder. You know, that was another one where it plays in really heavily. And, you know, when you're talking about movies of this era, it's like, if that's not part of the conversation, then is the movie even worth talking about? Like, you know, really... To grasp what was happening in Hollywood. And, you know, the more I learn about like really what was going on, the more I just kind of shake my head. You know, it all really started because they were trying to form the Writers Guild and they were just like, you know, the Writers Guild, that's, you know, socialist activity. That's, you know, communism. And because of that, it just kind of got linked to like, capital C communism, which it wasn't. And, you know, it was just like, well, really, that's all what it was about.
As is alluded to in a mutual favorite of ours, Hail Caesar.
Yes. I think about Hail Caesar anytime I'm watching something that is, you know, filmed around like the 50s or whatever that has anything going on with writers that are, you know, in any way affiliated or whatever with, you know, Communist Party or socialism or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, also comes up most certainly in Oppenheimer. You know, we also get a glimpse into, like, you know, how that went down and the things that people were looking out for. It's like, oh, you signed your name on a piece of paper one time.
Oh, I mean, anything in it's also coming up. I've been listening to the audio version of a recent biography of John Steinbeck, and comes up. I just jump between audiobooks, but it talks a lot about, excuse me, Steinbeck and his wife and their back and forth. His wife more so, but Steinbeck because of his activism and his work, especially advocating for migrant workers in labor camps and the, you know, treatment of migrant workers. He got slapped with that label and, like, not necessarily blacklisted, though he might have been. I don't necessarily think they stopped making films of his work, but it was major thing that affected especially the creative world, not just Hollywood.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I rewatched, I mean, maybe like half of Mank not too long ago. Mank isn't for me. I don't love Mank, but like to think about the elements of it in which, you know, the whole Red Scare and blacklisting, you know, kind of got tied in. That's the part that kind of interests me about it. And clearly I made a Citizen Kane reference earlier, and there's that. So before I get to my what I didn't like list, Dan, were there things that we didn't talk about yet that you really liked about the movie?
Well, let's see, things that I really liked about the movie. So the editing, the cinematography, we've talked about the Gary Cooper eye acting.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I really like. There are there are some of the scenes that you mentioned that I want to come back to, but for other reasons. So let's hear your quibbles.
Sure. A lot of the times when I was watching it, not as a marshal, but as a person, I kind of felt like Kane sucked a little bit. I didn't feel like he was really listening to Amy. It's like I would have liked to have seen more of an inner struggle between, like, should I do what I feel like I need to do because of Miller? Or should I do what I feel like? I feel like he should have wanted to be with, you know, doing what Amy wanted a little bit more. And I wanted to kind of see that struggle. Or, like, if there could have been an additional scene somewhere wedged in there where he's like, you know, he goes to the church and tries to rally people together and nobody wants to do it. And he's just like, what am I even doing? Like, I'm supposed to be on a honeymoon, like I'm supposed to be like starting a new life with this woman who hates that I'm doing this. Like, I wish that there was some sort of moment like that.
Yeah. And I get that. I feel like the closest it comes to that is the scene where he's writing out his last will and testament, because that was the scene where I was watching it and he's writing his last will and I'm like, you got married like an hour ago.
Yeah, not even. Like, yeah, hardly an hour ago.
Yeah. You got married like an hour ago and you were like, you got to like the town line and decided to turn back. Yeah, no, it's very alpha male in that way. And to a certain extent, I wonder I doubt there was any consideration given to that, but I wonder in terms of the message that they wanted to send about standing up. But no, I agree. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
There. And I honestly doubt it was considered, because let's face it, this is still a Western being made in Hollywood in the early 1950s.
Sure. Yeah. Listen,
but the scene where he's writing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say, if 1952 Grace Kelly told me to do literally anything, I would do it in a second. That's, I mean,
sorry, I was just about to say I would drive off a cliff, but
yeah, not so much. But you know, thinking about this movie, Grace Kelly is, you know, has this man in her life who is not respecting the like one element of her that she feels like is most important, and also like Grace Kelly in Rear Window, who's just like vying for this attention of this unavailable man. It's just like, what is wrong with men in Grace Kelly movies?
Oh, although I have to say, I think she's got the better deal here with Will Kane than with Jimmy Stewart. Cause Jimmy Stewart was like,
oh, at least he's got hobbies.
At least he's got hobbies. But this other guy is like, and here's where, here's where maybe like I get the Will Kane, like I need to do this, is that it sounds like this, like Hadleyville was kind of like Biff Tannen's alternate Hill Valley.
Okay.
Before Will Kane showed up. So, and they don't give you a ton of detail, but they do mention a few times, like, do you remember when a decent woman couldn't walk the street and when you couldn't raise children here? So yeah. I feel like for him, it's like, that's what echoes. And he's like, if I leave town, there's no marshal. The deputy quits, but like the deputy is that guy, is Harv. You're opening, you're just letting, it doesn't matter who's going to come in the next day, because Frank Miller clearly doesn't waste any time. He gets off the train and says, let's do this.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Man doesn't stop to take a piss.
Okay. But if there was a moment where, and maybe this is when Harvey does encourage Will to, you know, get on a horse and get out of there. And I wish that there would have been just like a moment where Will was just like, do you think that I want to be here? Like, I want nothing more than to just like take off and start my new life. But that means that you would be in charge, and leaving you in charge I do not have the faith in you to do this. If you can prove to me, you have 3 minutes, prove to me that you are capable of handling this situation so that this town does not go back 10 years and done, we're good, I'm out of here. But that's not going to happen.
Right. No. And I mean, Harvey like kind of proves his worth when he just kind of goes off and gets drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And tries to push Helen around, and Helen's like, please.
Helen's like, I don't think so, bozo.
Yeah. Like, I've been with Frank Miller and Will Kane. Yeah. You are a boy. I've been with Frank Miller. I've been with Will Kane. Hell, I've been with the 14-year-old kid who wants to be a deputy. Like, no, you don't measure up.
Well,
been with the one eye.
Well, you know, that's when, you know, the kid says that he's 16. It's because he's kind of aged a few years, because he had, 10 minutes with Helen Ramirez. So, one other thing that I didn't like, which we talked about before, was the Kane and Amy age difference. It's just completely gross. That is not cool. What I'm about to say next is spoiler territory. So if you do not want this movie,
spoiler alert.
I know. I don't have that button right now.
I know. Well, I can do it. It's fine.
There you go. So I didn't like that Kane shot first. When he gets their attention, they turn around and he shoots and kills one of the guys first. I don't remember which one it was. And I feel like there's... And granted, yes, of course they're going to try to just shoot him immediately, but there's no attempt to just like somehow try to talk with them for like a second before just completely going into a gunfight. And to me, it's like, oh, you don't want to even try to, you're just like, I'm outnumbered, they're going to kill me, My only chance is just to kill them. And it's like, you know that your wife is so anti-gun violence. They're, you know, putting a note in the middle of town at least would have been some sort of, you know, attempt at reason. But that's not what happens. So
punch and pie, high noon 30, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. High noon 30.
Yeah, well, so, you know, you got it because also remember, he's got to take time to read the note. And then after that, like, they're going to want to gather their thoughts. You don't want to meet with them right away. But, and I wonder, just playing devil's advocate here, I wonder how much, and by the way, if this is plausible, it might not be set up well enough, but when they talk about how Miller made that threat when he was in the courtroom about coming back and killing Will. Right. I mean, it's like, who doesn't, like, who's not, like, you know, everybody says that, I'm sure. I don't know.
I've been in
a courtroom, but not in that situation. So,
yeah, no.
No, but so I just wonder, I think maybe there's a lot that's hinted at, but that we don't get.
Yeah.
Such as that context and the understanding of how bad it was. But, you know, we'll come back to that.
And perhaps it could have even been like, you know, the train station guy. Clearly he's going to see them. And if he was just to say, I have a message from Will Kane. And he's just saying, like, this is between you and me. Please don't get the town involved. I'm not even there. You know, please let's, you know, try and figure something else out.
Not the marshal anymore. Just plain old Citizen Kane.
I'm Citizen Kane. Leave me alone, bro. I don't know.
Yep. Comrade Kane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And this one, I want to make sure that I'm clear with how I'm saying this. And this is, again, kind of spoilerly. I'm spoilerly.
You don't mean to be spoilerly, but the comment will be spoilery.
So I didn't 100% love the ending. I like that, you know, he throws the badge in the dirt and whatever. I'm not saying that I would have wanted him to, like, say something about it. But, like, you know, the townspeople all come out and they're just, like, you know, huddling around. You know, the whole gunfight is resolved with Amy as one of the assailants.
Yep. Spoiler alert. Backing Will up.
Yeah. And I think that I just would have maybe what would have made it better is if, yeah, he throws down his badge or whatever, but maybe we, like, pan out like a big crane shot going back and we see Amy, like, walking away, where she's just like, okay, that happened. I cannot be involved with this ever again. And just, like, leaves. But that's
fool
not
me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Yeah.
I said I was done with this life. Yeah. Look what you made me do. So maybe that, like, a kind of a repeat of that long crane shot, but where he's surrounded by all these people who deserted him, but the one person who was there for him cannot be there for him anymore. Yeah, I like that. I like I'm down with
just
that.
Just, like, one little tweak. I wouldn't have changed anything else, but, like, if she was just to kind of leave him and, you know, it's probably too late to join Ramirez on the train. That train has probably already left, but, you
know. The train has literally left the station.
The train has left the station. So yeah, that's what I got. That's my list of things that I like didn't love so much about it. But yeah, I don't know, Dan. Were there things that bumped you that we haven't talked about?
You know, not other than the age difference, and there wasn't really much else that bothered me. I definitely see your point about the ending.
Yeah.
And yeah, I definitely see your points and was, you know, just, I don't know, I guess took it more at face value.
Yeah.
But I do want to bring up something I love about this movie, which was not at all intended when they made it, but that I saw this movie long after the first, second, third, probably 20th time I saw Blazing Saddles. There were certain images that looked very familiar, and then the scene in the church when...
You know, I haven't watched Blazing Saddles in a long time. I gotta watch it again.
You definitely need to watch Blazing Saddles, because the church scene where they're starting to talk about it, and then they even stop talking about whether or not they should be his deputies, and they're like, let's wire the governor. And that's a line for Blazing Saddles, but it's the same. It's like the same setup. And there's the one guy who gets him as, I can't believe what I'm hearing here. And like the old drunk in Blazing Saddles. And it was, I think, filmed in the same.
Oh, was it really? Old West Town.
So therein lies the explanation of my story of how I've been to Hadleyville, New Mexico.
I knew you'd get to it eventually.
Oh, of course. No, I saw that path. I knew where it was going. And here we are. So back in 1998, because I don't know if you could, if how this is done now, but back in 1998, I took a tour of the Warner Brothers Burbank studio and lot. And it was really nice. Like it's an actual tour of a studio. And at the time, as a kid who was looking to get into film, it was really exciting to see like where they were, to look into one of those huge buildings and see like an outer space set for the Kurt Russell movie Soldier, or to drive past where they're shooting ER and like Noah Wiley's out there in his scrubs having a cigarette. So, and then the tour got to the Old West Town and we got to walk around. I have a couple of pictures.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere. Yeah. Yep. I have a couple of pictures. I think I know where they are. I'll dig them up. But
please.
On that street in the Old West Town, you see like the outside of the saloon. It looks more like Blazing Saddles. I think probably also because Blazing Saddles was in color.
Right. Yeah. They also, you know, they add things and take things away and change things depending on what the movie is. And
like it didn't still say Ramirez Saloon.
I couldn't imagine it would.
But for me visiting there, for me, it was being where they filmed Blazing Saddles. But then when I saw High Noon, I was like, oh, that is the same street as Blazing Saddles. And I think that like there's a few more things, like the scene when the Miller gang is first riding through town and you see the people go inside and like board up their windows. I think there's a scene in Blazing Saddles like that, like maybe when Mongo is riding through town. So I love that it reminds me of Blazing Saddles, and I love that scene. And I find that scene in the church to be so funny because it's so much like Blazing Saddles didn't go that much farther than what they're already doing.
Yeah, totally.
And I love it. And it's brilliant. Blazing Saddles turns 50 this year.
Wow. 50 this year, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then it's a perfect opportunity to give it another watch.
You could probably.
Especially after High Noon.
And at some point this year, you could probably find it playing in a theater. That's one I wouldn't mind seeing in a crowded theater. But another thing that I wondered about with Blazing Saddles, and this kind of comes back to that crane shot And I watched it, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe these were telegraph wires and it was totally fine. But like, I felt like I could see the electrical wires in the background, and that it looked, I was like, it doesn't look like flat desert.
I didn't notice that. I do know that that crane shot, it was done because it wasn't like intended originally, but there was like a production next to where they were shooting that had a crane that day that they weren't using. And so they used it for the movie, and I'm glad that they did. So maybe they weren't like fully planned, like properly to do a shot like that and like hide certain things.
But it made me wonder, I didn't think about this the first time I saw it when I made connections to Blazing Saddles, but this time I watched it, and this was on my second viewing this time, so technically my third viewing. The part of Blazing Saddles when they kind of pan back and you see that they're on the Warner Brothers lot plainly, like when they run, they like crash into the sets and everything. I was like, wait a second, are they spoofing the fact that in High Noon you can kind of
I doubt that.
I don't know.
But I also love the idea that you would pull the crane back even further, and it would reveal, yes, that they are in a 2024 modern day, and it's a village situation, and it's
spoilers. I mean, that's exactly for the village. What it is at Blazing Saddles, and like, and there's, oh, you mean if you pull like a village, like the village, like the M. Night village. Shyamalan's Shyamalan. The village,
yeah.
Oh. The Miller gang were coming to tell everybody that it's really 2024.
Yeah, right?
It's like Will Cain can't leave. Will Cain is like Truman, and it's like they keep, Ed Harris is up there, and he's like, no, Will, you have to turn back. You have to turn back, or the town will turn bad again.
Frank Miller gets off the train and looks at his like Apple Watch, and he's like, well, noon on the dot. These trains work. Amtrak really has it dialed in. So Dan,
it to the Truman Show, I'm thinking about like that Amy is like the Natasha McElhenney character in the Truman Show.
Wonderful. Before we get to out what we would kind of do with High Noon, we should acknowledge High Noon Part 2, The Return of Will Cain, which stars Lee Majors. Who else is in that? David Carradine. I watched the first like half hour, and then I was like, I've seen enough. But basically, Will and Amy come back to town, and they're gonna, I think, like open up a ranch, and so they're buying horses, and then like this other gang comes to town that's like wanted, and it's this whole other thing, and I didn't continue watching because I was like, I've seen enough.
And nobody else backs him up again.
Yeah, right. Who knows? I don't know. I don't know what Noon would have to do with anything if they're still going with the High Noon thing. But it was also just like them leaving town is kind of what needs to happen and stay the same. Like they shouldn't come back to town. Also, there is the 2000 Tom Skerritt, Marina Conchita Alonso remake of High Noon.
Yeah, Maria Conchita Alonso. That's great. That's awesome.
Yeah,
I love her.
I saw her in there. I was like, awesome, Maria Conchita Alonso. Yeah.
I mean, man, talk about someone who like has not gotten her due yet. I feel like for her contributions as an actress and a leading actress,
she's fantastic.
Especially in a lot of male dominated films in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. So
and don't forget like
Shanghai Noon, right?
Which really, other than the title has really very little to do with this.
Yeah, I was thinking of watching that one. I was like, there's no reason.
I saw that in the theater. I did.
Oh yeah,
and I did just say theater. I don't know why.
I wasn't gonna call you on it, but I heard it.
I don't know. I said and my voice just went Ader, and there it just happened. I was thinking about the idea of like, of him not coming back. And I think that that's like, it's really important that he doesn't come back, because especially because all those people come out at the end. I want to be like, aren't any of them like embarrassed? Because they all thought he was going to get killed. Otherwise, they would have been backing him up. If they were like, oh, he could probably get this on his own. Yeah. They would have been right there with him, but they all thought he was going to be dead, and they come out there and like, fuck you. You're on your own now, Hadleyville.
Yeah, totally. I don't know.
Had it with Hadleyville.
Yeah. So there's a reason why High Noon Part 2, The Return of Will Kane, isn't up there in the upper echelon of cinematic greatness.
No, it is not treated as canon. Plus, what was it like, a made for VHS?
I don't know how it was released, but oh wait, it first aired on CBS in a 2-hour time slot. And Dan, the person who wrote it is, and I'm going to start describing, you know, this writer's career trajectory, which is what's surprising about this. And if you happen to guess it, chime in. Otherwise, I will tell you. But it is this is somebody who got started writing Westerns in the 50s, probably going into the 60s, and then went into writing more of like detective novels. And
Is it like Elmore Leonard?
It is Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Elmore Leonard. So I like neo-noir stuff. So I was fascinated by the fact that this was 1980 that this happened. I was like, really? 1980? Elmore Leonard is writing a sequel to High Noon.
Elmore Leonard needed to get paid.
I guess so. I mean, I guess there hadn't been as many adaptations of his work coming out.
I mean, in 1980, we're 15 years away from Get Shorty, and I mean I know that there's others, but man's gotta work.
I first I saw it and I was like, could it be a different Elmore Leonard? And it's like, nope, that's most certainly
L
him.
Period more,
yeah.
Leonard, like L. Ron Hubbard.
Out of Sight, you know, Get Shorty, clearly.
I mean, Rum Punch, Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
Elmore Leonard's got like just a run of like bangers.
Inherent Vice was Elmore Leonard, right?
No, that was Thomas Pynchon.
Thomas Pynchon, right.
Yes. Wacky.
Same vibe.
Yeah.
But going back to the 2000 film, I feel like Tom Skerritt is a good choice for a Will Kane type.
Yeah, okay.
I love Tom Skerritt
2000. I know, I love Tom Skerritt too. But
for a TBS movie, Tom Skerritt is a great choice. Oh, Michael Madsen is in it.
All right. Is he one of the bad guys?
He's got to be one of the bad guys. Let me see. Frank Miller. There you go. So there you have it.
That's good casting right there.
So, Dan, what would you do to bring back High Noon?
Well, John, first of all, before I launch into it, I should also point out that I saw online that we are recording this on April 15th, 2024. And on April 16th, 2020. Yes, on April 16th, 2024, Kino Lorber's 4K Blu-ray of High Noon comes out.
I did see that 4K Ultra HD. They just released the Brain Donors Blu-ray.
Yeah. So anyway, that's relevant and that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny because I think of these, like I look at my phone and I'm like, oh, is it just bringing up something from 5 years ago because I've been talking about the movie High Noon? It's like, nope, that's happening tomorrow.
Kino Lorber, they do such great work. And I'd be curious to see like what kind of bonus features they have for that. If they've gotten some like new commentaries the way that they've done before and the way they did with the Brain Donors Blu-ray. Which is fantastic. And so that's great news.
They are one of those companies that is kind of doing what they can to provide the Criterion experience for films that are not likely to be chosen by Criterion.
Correct. Yeah.
Though, I mean...
High Noon.
High Noon. High Noon is probably already in the Criterion collection.
Yeah, it could be.
Like, that might have been a first ballot pick for, like, the first collection.
Spine 0001.
Seriously. Or it would have been better if it was 12, because Noon.
So, oh, yeah, that's true. Is it Criterion?
The Criterion
Criterion Collection released it on Laserdisc.
Yeah, see, it was probably one, I'm telling you, like in the first Criterion Collection when we're like, hey, we're this company that does this shit with movies. And here's one for High Noon.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Tell me I was right. I was joking, but I'm like, don't tell me I was right that it was the first one. So I would do a prequel because I want to see how, in all due respect with Amy, probably before she comes along.
Yeah. And an Amy-centered one focusing on what happened with her family.
Well, so you do a couple of prequels. You do two prequels. You do a prequel about Hadleyville. I would want to see Hadleyville where it's
pre-Giuliani. Like,
Wow. No, because we're supposed to like Will Kane. Although, right, but maybe that's it. But maybe that's it. Maybe your prequel becomes an allegory for the Giuliani years in New York City. And for those who just think of Rudy Giuliani as like the silly blubbering guy who follows Trump around.
Four Seasons, Total Landscaping Giuliani.
That guy. So Rudolph Giuliani became the mayor of New York City in like 2000, 2001. I forget exactly when, but the mayor before that was a Democrat, and a lot of things had gotten, you know, New York got very New York, and seedy New York got very seedy, and, you know, the sex shops, porn theaters, all that, and sex workers. And Giuliani came in.
It was when Times Square wasn't M&M stores. It was S&M stores.
Yes. Wow. Damn. That's that quote of the week there. We've never done one before. It's the first one.
Thank you.
But exactly.
Somebody has to have said that before, right?
Like, not to me, and not on the Rune Childhoods podcast. So I don't care. You're the first.
Okay,
and
that's cool,
awesome.
Cool.
And it's so true. But then Giuliani came in and like a fascist kind of like swept up, like took all the, but they bust the homeless out.
They did. Yeah.
And it was kind of like one of those things where as a child, you were just like, Oh, New York's not scary anymore. That's great. But then as an adult, when you're like, oh, how did New York get unscary? You're like, but that's kind of scary too.
Yeah.
Anyway, and also Rudolph Giuliani got a lot of respect and was known as America's mayor after the attacks on September 11th.
Yeah.
And that he was really, you know, down there and, wasn't hiding in an office and was in that moment a leader.
Right.
And that was his peak. The low point for this country was the high point for Rudy Giuliani.
So you want to see Hadleyville pre-Kane, when things were rough, when Frank Miller was running amok.
I think that's where I want to commit. I want to see how Will came in and clean stuff up. It sounds like there maybe was a little love triangle with him, Frank, and Helen.
Yeah.
So, like, what's all the heat there? Like, there's definitely a lot of reference to, like, this is personal between Will and Miller.
Yeah.
So I want to know, like, what's the history? Did Kane come into town and Miller was like, hey, I'm going to cut you in on all the action if you turn a blind eye?
Right.
And he was like, you don't know me. That's not how I roll.
Maybe it could also be like an Austin Powers Dr. Evil thing where like they went to, you know, they grew up together being like best friends. And then there was like some sort of incident where that like pulled them apart. Maybe it was meeting Helen Ramirez.
Isn't it funny how Austin Powers did that before James Bond did it?
That's true.
It didn't occur to me until you mentioned it. And I was like, oh, that's like Spectre. But that was like 20 years after Goldmember.
Oh my God, you're right.
Or not 20 years, 10 years, but wow.
It wasn't in any of the books that like he and Blofeld had some sort of past together.
I don't know. No, because it's not funny. In any of the prior movies.
Jeez, that's ridiculous.
That's
who knew awesome. on the High Noon episode we'd be uncovering an hour and 9 minutes into it. Almost the duration of High Noon.
It makes sense because earlier we were discussing how for me and also for you, Blazing Saddles came first in the viewing, even though High Noon came first in chronology.
Yeah.
But now the joke in Austin Powers became the plot material of what it was parodying, but before that had been created. I am dizzy.
That's amazing.
Did that make sense to anyone other than me?
Well,
doesn't matter. I have a feeling. What would you do?
Well, and that leads into what I would do, because that would be a perfect conversation to happen in my iteration of High Noon. That's a stoner comedy. So, High Noon. Noon is the new 420, could be its tagline. And it is
Might be listening to this on 420, folks, because it'll be out by then.
Yeah, that's true. So, it would be kind of just like a modern day retelling of something like this. Perhaps it happens on like a college campus and it's not necessarily like a marshal, but it's like the head of a frat or something, you know, it's like something like that. I don't have it all dialed in, but I feel like the stoner comedy element of it, a genre that has kind of slipped away a little bit, that I feel could have a nice little resurgence. I don't know. Have there been any like stoner comedies recently?
And when you say stoner comedies, you're saying comedies about stoners.
Right.
Well, it looks like this new Chris Pine thing, the pool man, where he's the pool man.
Oh, that does seem interesting. I don't know if that's so much of a, I mean, it's, I'm thinking more of like a younger people romp.
You're thinking more of a Half-Baked, right?
More of a Half-Baked,
less of a Lebowski.
Exactly.
Idle Hands.
Yeah, the new Chris Pine one looks good, though. I think he directed that, I think.
Yeah. And actually, Chris Pine, by the way, is on my list of people who I would cast to play the, you know, 5 to 10 years younger version of Will Caine.
Oh, okay.
I have a short list.
There was somebody who tweeted, I wish I could remember who tweeted this, but they were just like, Chris Pine is short for Christmas Pine Tree. And I think that's just the funniest thing.
You know what? And so it is. And so it is.
Also, it's like Chris Pine is such a delight. When he shows up in things, I'm happy. He does an excellent job. He seems like a decent person. I've never heard anything to the contrary.
Too seriously.
Right. Yeah.
I appreciate
absolutely.
That.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if any of you have any ideas of what you would do with High Noon, please email us, ruinedchildhoodspod@gmail.com. We're on Instagram at ruinedchildhoodspod. All of our stuff is at ruinedchildhoodspod.com. And Dan, why don't you tell everybody what we're doing in our next episode of the show?
Well, because this round trip is geographically very inconvenient, we are going... We have gone from New Jersey to New Mexico, and we're just like bungee jumping across the country because we are springing back to New York. And of course,
Of New York and Giuliani.
And New York, but not New York City. We are outside of the Giuliani's jurisdiction because we're going to the Catskills. We're going to the 1960s. We're going to Kellerman's, John. We're going to watch Dirty Dancing, directed by Emil Ardolino, starring Jennifer Grey, Patrick Swayze, Cynthia Rhodes, Jerry Orbach. Yes.
God, Jerry Orbach. And we'll talk about this on the next episode quite a bit, but he is a recurring character on Murder, She Wrote. Because if you're a listener of the podcast, you know that I'm obsessed with Murder, She Wrote going from beginning to end. Currently in season 7, he plays a character that is a private eye based out of Boston. And he is an absolute delight. He's hilarious.
Is he a competitor? Is he like kind of a friendly rivalry or no?
No. They're friends. I mean, they meet when they are both kind of like investigating a situation, but it's the type of thing where like he will call her or she will call him for help, things like that. Like she hires him on for something in the most recent episode that I watched. So
it's not the same character from Law and Order, right?
No, it is not. It is not. But he is so funny. I love Jerry Orbach. I'm excited to watch him in Dirty Dancing because I haven't seen Dirty Dancing since I started watching Murder, She Wrote. And it's a classic.
Great watch, great soundtrack.
Great Swayze.
Great. You know, here on Rune Childhoods, we are crazy for Swayze.
We certainly are. Well, Dan, as you are, I don't know, catching the noon train to, well, I guess it'll be New York in this case, I wish you a good journey.
Good journey.